I'm Bill Moyers. It's good to have your ear. Thanks for joining us. Scientist David Suzuki on climate change and the free market.
Oh, the market! Praise the market! Free the market! It'll do it. We invented the damn thing. What's going on here? Like, we act as if these are forces of nature. You know, there are some things in nature we have to live with. Physics, chemistry, biology. Those tell you.
Reality, right?
But why is it we bow down before human-created ideas? We can change those things. We can change our dependence on the biosphere for our well-being and survival. I don't get it. If it ain't working, change the darn thing.
Thanks for joining us. When David Suzuki was born, his Japanese-Canadian father worried that his son's diminutive size would put him at a disadvantage in the world. So he named him after little David of the Old Testament, the young warrior who slew the mighty Philistine giant Goliath and became the king of Israel. Suzuki's father would live long enough to realize with pride that his son had lived up to his name. David Suzuki has become famous around the world for using science to fight the predatory giants who ravage the earth for profit.
I can tell you, everybody who looks at that knows in the pit of your stomach this is wrong. You do not treat Mother Earth this way.
Now he's in the fiercest and most urgent battle of his long life to reverse the warming of our planet caused by the global emissions of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. It's an uphill struggle. Just this week, the White House released the latest National Climate Assessment, which reports that global warming is real, that summers are longer and hotter, and extended periods of unusual heat last longer than any living American has ever experienced. This is far from the first time David Suzuki has witnessed the worst, but carried on the battle. His childhood was spent in a Canadian internment camp during World War II. Facing lingering bigotry after the war, the family was forced out of British Columbia and moved to Ontario. After getting his Ph.D. in zoology at the University of Chicago, David again encountered racial intolerance, this time in the segregated American South, when he did postdoctoral work in genetics at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. Undeterred, he began a 40-year teaching career in higher education. His knack for translating difficult scientific principles into something understandable and exciting made him a natural for television. Since 1979, he's been the host of the Canadian Broadcasting Science series, The Nature of Things, seen over the decades in more than 40 countries.
Welcome to the first show in a new season of
The Nature of Things.
His name appears on over 50 books as author or collaborator, and in a poll of his fellow Canadians last fall, Suzuki was named the country's most admired figure. Nonetheless, his outspoken views on climate change and the government's collusion with the petrochemical industry in developing the country's oil-rich tar sands have made him the target of relentless attacks from Canada's prime minister, corporations, and right-wing ideologues. He takes these in stride and now sees himself as an elder, like the oldest of his First Nation tribal friends in northwestern Canada. Elders, he recently wrote me, are free to speak the truth that comes from our hearts, to sift through our lives for those nuggets of experience to pass on to the generations that will inherit the world we leave. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How old are you now?
I'm 78.
Don't you think that we hope to grow old but dread old age?
Well, yes. I mean, no one... I called myself an elder reluctantly, but having seen the role of elders in First Nations communities, it's something that I now feel very proud to say I am an elder. Elders in a First Nations community, you go to a feast or an event, when an elder walks in the room, they're like rock stars. You know, they're the repository of all of that long traditional knowledge that's been, again, hard won over thousands of years. And that is passed on.
What would you like to pass on? I mean, what are some nuggets of experience from your own life that you think might be instructive and helpful to future generations?
They're all about stories. And one that comes to mind immediately, we were doing a show, a two-hour special on forestry. And I arranged with McMillan Bloedel, one of the big logging companies, to interview three loggers on Vancouver Island. And so we rolled up and pulled out our camera. The loggers saw us. They were waiting, and they came out of the bush. And they're cussing me and saying, you XX enviros, you're taking our jobs away. And I started arguing. And it was great television. You know, people love that. But at the end of this exchange, I said, you know, I don't know a single environmentalist who's against logging. We use paper, we use lumber. We're not against logging. We just want to be sure your kids and grandchildren will be able to log forests as rich as the ones you're cutting now. Right away, one of the loggers jumped in and said, there's no way my kids are going into logging. There aren't going to be any trees left. And that's when I understood, or I realized that we weren't talking to each other. They were talking about, look, I've got to put food on the plate every day. I've got to pay my car for my car and my mortgage. They're looking at it in terms of immediate needs. Whereas what we were arguing was the long-term protection of the forest that could continue to yield wood and pulp forever if we do it the right way. But we were arguing in different ways. And I think that's one of the most important lessons, is when we begin a conversation, let's at least start from a common ground so that we know what we're talking about. Otherwise, we're just talking past each other.
How do you reach common ground there?
If we can't both agree that the health of the forest is critical, as long as those trees are healthy, that forest is healthy, loggers can make a living at it. And those forests, that forest will provide the services that all of humanity needs, which is taking carbon out of the air and putting oxygen back in and holding the soil so it doesn't erode and providing habitat. Those are the kind of ecological services I'm interested in. But if we both agree the health of the forest is the source of our well-being, either as a log. See, that's where I think the story of the goose that laid the golden eggs is so relevant. You know, as long as the goose is fat and healthy and you take care of it, it would lay a golden egg every day. But you get greedy and kill the goose, there's no golden eggs to be got.
In her foreword to your book, The Legacy, Margaret Atwood says, you have lived the life of the great prophets, those whose messages go unheeded because they tell us things we find uncomfortable. But there was a time when your messages were heeded. And you helped win some very important battles back there in the 70s and the 80s. Now you seems to me you're fighting those same battles all over again. What does that tell us?
That was the shock to me. We celebrated great victories in the 1970s and 80s, stopping clear cutting of these forests or drilling for oil off the coast of British Columbia, stopping big dams that were to be built in Brazil and in northern British Columbia, stopped supertankers from Alaska going down to Seattle. And here we are, 30, 35 years later, and we're fighting the same battles. And what I've said is that this is a signal that we as environmentalists have fundamentally failed. We've failed to shift the perceptual lenses through which we see our place on the planet. You see, we thought if we stop that dam, whoa, we've won. That's it.
Right.
And we didn't point out, why are we stopping the dam? What does it mean? What are the values inherent in that battle and that victory? We just saw the battle as the issue, and we never saw it as simply part of the symptoms of a greater change that's needed. And so we failed, the common expression is to shift the paradigm. And that really is the challenge. Of environmentalism is really about seeing our place in the world in the way that humans have always known up until very, very recently, that we're part of nature and utterly dependent on the natural world for our well-being and survival. You know, when I think of our evolution as an animal in Africa, when we appeared on the plains of Africa, you got to admit we weren't very impressive. We weren't fast, we weren't big, we weren't strong, we didn't have special sensory abilities. I mean, who could have imagined that in 150 millennia we would take over the planet? Well, of course, our secret was hidden. It was the 2-kilogram organ buried deep in our skulls. And one of the things that brain did was it enabled us to create this concept of a future. No other animal has a sense of a future as we do. And because we invented the idea of a future, we're the only animal that understood that we could affect the future by what we do today.
But at the same time, you have said that we are a special predatory species.
Well, we are very special in that we've amplified our ability way beyond any other species through technology. Mm-hmm. And
we used to think technology would save us in these crises, such as the one we're...
Well, I think that there's no question we need technology. The problem we face is that when we go for big technology, we invariably wake up and find, oh my goodness, I didn't know that this is going to be a consequence. I mean, when DDT was found to kill insects, we thought, wow, that's great. You know, sprayed on fields and killed pests. The guy that discovered that, Paul Mueller, won a Nobel Prize in 1948. But only years later, we find, hey, guess what? DDT doesn't stay in a farmer's field, and it's biomagnified up the food chain. We only discovered
that.
Into the breasts of women, the shell glands of birds. That's why eagles were disappearing. And over again, we get tripped up because we can invent a powerful technology, but we don't know enough to see the ramifications. So I think there's a way out, and that is if we show nature more respect. I mean, after all, every species has had the same problem we do. I mean, they've had to get rid of their waste. What do you do when you get sick? Even bacteria get virus sicknesses that kill them. How do you get your food? How do you have kids and raise them safely? How do you find shelter? I mean, these are all common problems of other species. But nature's had 3.8 billion years to solve them. Could we not find ways that nature's done it, then make that our technology?
But what those species didn't face was a tsunami of money and power, a raid against them the way you and all of us now are facing the power, greed, and wealth of these big fossil fuel companies. Is it practical to think we can change the paradigm when we're up against that wall of money?
Well, I keep saying that the economic system is a human invention. The idea of capitalism, free enterprise, corporations, markets, these are not forces of nature, for heaven's sake. But you talk to a neoliberal and you say the market, and they go, oh, the market, praise the market, free the market, it'll do it. We invented the damn thing. What's going on here? Like, we act as if these are forces of nature. You know, there are some things in nature we have to live with. Physics, chemistry, biology, those tell you.
Reality, right?
But why is it we bow down before human-created ideas? We can change those things. We can't change our dependence on the biosphere for our well-being and survival. I don't get it. If it ain't working, change the darn thing.
Some young people in California are suing government agencies here for failing to act on climate change. They're part of an organization called Our Children's Trust, and they're invoking the public trust doctrine that says sovereign governments have a duty to safeguard public resources for the use of subsequent generations.
But they've just lost.
But they're going to take it up to an appeals
court. Good
for them.
I've been saying for years that that our politicians should be thrown in the slammer for willful blindness. If we are in a position of being able to act and we see something going on and we refuse to acknowledge the threat or act on it, we can be taken to court for willful blindness. I think that we are being willfully blind to the consequences for our children and grandchildren. It's an intergenerational crime. Unfortunately, there is no category for that kind of criminal act. In Canada, we're starting a campaign in September. I'm going to go on a bus and we're going to drive from the east coast of Canada across until November. And we're pushing for a constitutional amendment to make the right to a healthy environment enshrined in our Constitution.
Are there countries getting climate change right? Are there countries that are doing the right thing?
Well, lots. Lots. I mean, the countries that signed the Kyoto Protocol, other than Canada, which withdrew, have all met the target, which was a small target. Sweden, I hold up as this shining example. They instituted a carbon tax in the 1990s. I think it was around 1992. They now pay $130 or $140 a ton to put carbon in the atmosphere. They've reduced their greenhouse gas emissions by more than 8% below 1990 levels. And during that time, their economy grew by more than 40%. So this whole argument that a carbon tax, putting a price on carbon, is destructive of the economy is really bogus if we look at a country like Sweden. But, you know, Germany is well on its way to shutting down all of their nuclear plants and 50% renewable energy by 2020 or something. Denmark, Sweden, they're all well on their way to transitioning off fossil fuels.
You once said, quote, "All it takes is the imagination to dream it and the will to make the dream reality." But is imagination enough against our addiction to fossil fuels and the enormous wealth and power of those who feed our addiction?
Yes. Well, I think that one of the problems we face is that so much money has been invested in building the infrastructure. You know, tens and tens of billions of dollars have been invested. Chinese alone have invested over $20 billion. Right. You have all that asset. You've got to get that value out. You know, it's the stranded assets business that impels you to continue on what we all know is a destructive path. Now, I had thought triggers would be a crisis. So after Hurricane Katrina, I thought maybe that's it. You know, when 70,000 Europeans died of heat stroke, I thought maybe that's it. When Sandy occurred, I thought that's it. But in 2008, with the economic meltdown, I thought that's it. I think in terms of the power of corporations, most big corporations are bigger than most governments in the world. It's going to take a massive meltdown, and a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. So it's a pretty apocalyptic view of what's going to help us get on that path.
I heard a psychology professor at the Earth Institute here in New York say that, quote, scare campaigns and visions of apocalyptic futures backfire.
Yeah.
They only work when there's something simple you can do to remove the danger. Can you present climate change, the dangers and the threat, with a simple enough positive solution that enables people to accept, absorb, and act on it?
Yeah. Well, it's difficult, I think. I mean, there are all kinds of positive possibilities. But the important thing is to take the challenge seriously. And that's what we seem to be having trouble getting over that hurdle now. I was starting my last year in college in 1957. And on October 4th, 1957, the Soviet Union electrified the world by launching Sputnik. Now, you remember what it was like. I mean, I didn't even know there was a space program. And every time that satellite passed overhead, we heard that beep, 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 which was kind of like a reminder, you know, a finger up your nose saying, look at us, how great we are. And America just said, we got to do something about this. I mean, it was a glorious time. Americans spent money. Like, here I was, a Canadian in the United States, and all you had to do was say, I like science, and my goodness, there were scholarships and all kinds of things. And you know, meanwhile, the Russians launched the first animal, the dog, Laika, the first man, Yuri Gagarin, the first woman, Valentina Tereshkova. Americans didn't say, oh, God, we'll never get up. You catch up to them. They're too far ahead. It'll break the economy if we go after them. And when Kennedy announced the moon as a target, you threw yourselves into it. And I keep using this. Think of what happened as a result of the commitment. Not only are Americans the only country to land human beings on the moon, but all of the things that happened that we couldn't have predicted, you know, 24-hour news channel, well, maybe that's not such a great thing, but GPS and cell phones and more than just jobs, opened whole new areas that we didn't know were possible. And every year for 50 years, when Nobel Prizes are announced in science, guess who gets most of them? Americans. Because after Sputnik, America said, we've got to take the challenge and beat these guys. And I think it's un-American to say, this will destroy the economy. This is a challenge, for heaven's sakes. And where is that gung-ho American, you know, that let's go ahead and get on with it spirit?
David Suzuki tells us on next week's broadcast that the situation is critical, but it's not hopeless.
A lot of my colleagues have now said it's too late. We've passed too many tipping points to go back. My answer is, thank you for the message of urgency. We don't know enough to say it's too late. And this isn't some kind of Pollyanna-ish idea. I based that notion of our ignorance on reality, and I believe that nature has many more surprises if we can pull back and give her room. And that's the basis of my hope. And that's all I'm left with. I see where the curves are all going, but I still cling to hope as the thing that we've got to grab onto if we give nature a chance.
I'm Bill Moyers. It's good to have your ear. Scientist David Suzuki on capitalism and climate change.
The fossil fuel industry knows that fossil fuel use is at the heart of climate change. But the problem is their job as CEOs and executives is to make money for their shareholders, and they'll do it. There is no question that we're in a new extinction phase, but now it's being caused by one species alone, which is us. And as long as we carry on the conversation within a frame that is dictated by economics, then we're going to lose every time.
Thanks for joining us. Last week, the scientist David Suzuki was here to tell us what he thinks should happen to politicians who ignore or deny evidence that the Earth is heating up.
Our politicians should be thrown in the slammer for willful blindness. If we are in a position of being able to act and we see something going on and we refuse to acknowledge the threat or act on it, we can be taken to court for willful blindness. I think that we are being willfully blind to the consequences for our children and grandchildren. It's an intergenerational crime.
The problem is, if that should happen, if politicians were to be convicted of willful blindness to the fate of the Earth and future generations, there would have to be mass arrests and lots more funding for new prisons. We're not talking about a mere handful of culprits. It's hard even to know where to start. Perhaps with Marco Rubio, Republican senator from Florida. Back when he was a state legislator, Rubio favored cutting carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. But now, he's thinking about running for president in 2016 and has changed his tune, as ABC's Jonathan Carl learned this past weekend.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not. And I do not believe that the laws that they propose we pass will do anything about it, except it will destroy our economy.
As Paul Waldman wrote in the Washington Post this week, just about every potential candidate yearning for the Republican nomination publicly questions the scientific evidence of global warming. Among them, Ted Cruz, who says the last 15 years there has been no recorded warming. Bobby Jindal decries global warming as left-wing environmental theory. Rick Santorum calls climate change a beautifully concocted scheme. And Rand Paul says the Earth's 4.5 billion years old and you're going to say we had four hurricanes and so that proves a theory? These contenders have plenty of company, including the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell of coal-rich Kentucky, who says he doesn't buy climate change and regularly scorns President Obama for talking about the weather. Republican Representative Dana Rohrabacher says global warming is a total fraud. And he's from California, where every inch of the state is under siege from epic heat and drought. Then there's Representative Joe Barton, former GOP chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, who hails from Texas, which, the story goes, was created in only one day by the Almighty, who spent the rest of the week drilling for oil. Smokey Joe Barton says that Noah's great flood is an example of climate change, and that certainly wasn't because mankind had overdeveloped hydrocarbon energy. I'm not making this up. They really say these things. But they're not actually stupid. Playing dumb is just their game, to appease the base of Tea Party Republicans who watch only Fox News and don't really know better. And, of course, to keep the campaign contributions rolling in from the fossil fuel companies and predatory billionaires. But haul these fellas up on charges of willful blindness, and I'll wager they would all take the fifth. No one knows the ways politicians undermine action to stop global warming better than David Suzuki. This geneticist and zoologist, author and broadcaster, is known to many as the godfather of the environmental movement. Since 1979, he's hosted the Canadian TV series The Nature of Things, making science understandable and entertaining to audiences around the world. In his native Canada, he's fought hard against those science deniers in positions of power who have turned a blind eye to the future and the truth. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You once believed that if people were showed the valid science about global warming, they would understand. You were wrong about that.
Yeah.
It's not the case that you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free.
Yes, the discussion platform has been very, very badly polluted. I really did believe in my whole life. I had did my first television series in 1962, when even you were a young man too. And my belief was and still is that if we can have a conversation about the facts, that ultimately we can make the proper decisions. Well, it's a much more complicated affair. And what I'm realizing now is that as long as we carry on the conversation within a frame that is dictated by economics, then we're going to lose every time. And again, let me tell you a story. Many years ago, the Lytton Indian Band, they called themselves, came to me and said, our government has given a permit to log our Sacred Valley. The Sacred Valley is now called the Stein Valley. They gave a permit to Fletcher Challenge, a New Zealand forest company, and we don't want any logging to take place. So I said, okay, but before I work with you, I'd like to see what you're fighting to protect. So I took my family. We went camping in the valley for 5 days, and it's a magnificent valley. So as we were coming out, we met a big party of people, and the women were all dressed in high heels and dresses, and the men in suits and ties. And I said, this is not a camping party. But, you know, anybody on the trail you talk to. And so very quickly, I realized, holy smokes, this is the CEO of Fletcher Challenge. And very quickly, he realized, oh, my God, this is that troublemaker, David Suzuki.
Thank you.
So we got into, let's say, a heated discussion. And finally, he said in frustration, listen, Suzuki, are tree huggers like you willing to pay to protect those trees? Because if you're not willing to pay for them, they don't have any value to someone cuts them down. And that was a big insight for me because I realized, holy cow, you know, he's absolutely right. In his world, he could tell me how many jobs will come, how many board feet of lumber, how many cubic meters of pulp, how much profit can be made out of there. And what do I do? If I'm arguing in his frame and say, well, gee, every year we can pick a few berries and there are some salal bushes that we could use for flower arrangement and maybe we could find a cure for cancer. Like, we have no chance against that argument if we stay within an economic frame. Because the real reason we're fighting for the forest is that it's taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting oxygen back in it. Not a bad service for an animal like us. But economists don't have a place for that in their construct.
Well, how would you expect otherwise when, as you point out, the fossil fuel industry has deliberately embarked on a program to cast doubt
Yes.
on the science of global warming. They say you and others like you are practicing junk science, and they are winning the propaganda.
In the United States.
In the United States.
Yes, that has worked. What we do know from the magnificent book, Merchants of Doubt.
Merchants of Doubt.
You sow doubt. And since the 1990s, the fossil fuel industry has known, just as the tobacco industry knew years before they finally admitted it, that smoking caused cancer. The fossil fuel industry knows that fossil fuel use is at the heart of climate change. But now the problem is their job as CEOs and executives is to make money for their shareholders, and they'll do it. And if they begin to frame the discussion a different way, the chances are they'll be booted out of their position. So they've got no choice.
The paradox, as you speak, is that I saw a poll that said almost 90% of Canadians really take global warming seriously and know that we contribute to it, and yet their government is taking actions that are in direct contradiction to their understanding of global warming.
Yes.
The citizens understand.
Our government has come down hard. So environmentalists are called enemies of Canada.
By the Prime Minister?
By the Prime Minister, while his mouthpieces, his various ministers. We are called radical extremists. We had one minister who said, you have these extremist terrorists like bin Laden and environmentalists. So that's how we're being demonized by being lumped in as terrorists. And this is a very effective thing that we know that it's been done by the tobacco industry. It's being done by the fossil fuel industry. If you attack a person on the basis of their trustworthiness, their ulterior motives, anything to get away from dealing with what the issues they're raising, then, oh, but those darn scientists, they keep speaking out, so shut them down. We have fired a huge number of scientists working for Environment Canada.
Well, I did read that the government, your government, has closed libraries in the Department of Oceans and
Fisheries and Oceans.
Fisheries and Oceans.
That's
and,
right. Actually thrown out manuscripts into the garbage.
I mean, that's like the burning of books.
Exactly, exactly. And they muzzled the scientists that work for the government. A scientist cannot go out and talk to the public about what they are finding in their area of expertise. They have to go through the government and be vetted by the government in terms of what they can say. That really sends a chill through the scientific community, because other scientists who aren't working for government but are in universities depend on government grants in order to carry out their research, much more cautious in speaking out. It sends a chill, and that really scares me, because if you can't have scientists telling you what the grounds, the scientific information is on various issues, who then do we go to for the authority? Do we go to the Bible? Do we go to the Quran? Do we go to these right-wing think tanks? In Canada, we have the Fraser Institute, a very right-wing think tank that gets a lot of play in the press. Is that what our source is going to be? That's why it's really important to me that scientists not only be freed, but be recognized as the most authoritative source of information on these various issues.
And there was a Gallup poll in this country a few weeks ago that said, despite rising temperatures and all of this strange weather we've been having, the percentage of Americans who care a great deal about global warming has been dropping from 41% 6 years ago to 34% today. What is it about human nature that wants to believe the worst can't happen?
I don't know. I don't know. But I will tell you this. We think, or at least the science indicates, humans evolved. And I know in the United States the word evolution is loaded with all kinds of triggers. But in Canada, we use evolution all the time because people accept it. The science suggests we evolved in Africa 150,000 years ago. And for 95% of our existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. We had to follow plants and animals through the seasons. When you're a hunter-gatherer, you know darned well you are utterly dependent on nature for your well-being and survival. 10,000 years ago, we begin this big transition from hunter-gatherer to farmer. Agricultural revolution ushers in this huge change. Now we don't have to follow, we can raise our food right where we live. And in 1900, there were about 1.5 billion people in the world, only 14 cities with more than 1 million people. Most people still lived in rural village communities because most people were involved in some aspect of agriculture. come ahead 100 years to 2000. Now they're four times as many people, 6 billion people. More than 400 cities with a million people or more. Now in North America, the vast majority of people live in big cities. And in a big city, it's easy to think, well, as long as we have parks out there somewhere where we can camp and fish and play, who needs nature? In a city, my most highest priority is my job. And, you know, the average child in Canada today spends 8 minutes a day outside and over 6 hours a day in front of a television, computer, or cell phone screen. So when you're living that way, who needs nature? Who even worries about the weather unless there's a tornado or some kind of freak event? And so we act as if these things are really not relevant to the way we live. I remember when William Nordhaus, one of the giants in economics at Yale, said, oh, the impact of global warming is trivial economically. And I think that it's...
We now know that's not the case.
Of course, right. Of course. See, young kids often ask me, Mr. Suzuki, how can I save the world? And I say to them, well, look, the world's not in trouble. We're in trouble, but the world's not in trouble. So don't worry about the world.
So you say the world's not in trouble, but when I read some of what you've written and when I look at photographs and video of the tar sand, it seems to me the world's in serious trouble.
Well, the world,
you have a microcosm of it.
The world, the planet, is undergoing immense changes. Humans now are the major force shaping the properties and the functions within the biosphere. That's why scientists refer to this as the Anthropocene epoch, a period of time when human beings have become a geological force. We're altering the physical, chemical, and biological features of the planet on a geological scale. So there's no question the planet's undergoing change, but the planet is going to be here long after we're gone. The planet will continue to go on in this altered state. I have no doubt life will persist. We've gone through periods of tremendous extinction. There are five great extinction events that happen. We don't know why, but one of them, when the dinosaurs disappear, may have been caused by this collision with an asteroid and a cooling period. But the reality is it takes 10 to 20 million years for life to recover after one of these great extinction crises. And I don't know if you've interviewed Elizabeth Colbert, who's just
read a book,
The Sixth Extinction. And there's no question that we're in a new extinction phase, but now it's being caused by one species alone, which is us. Life will go on. Even if we heat up the planet to what is being projected as 4 to 6 degrees this century, which to me is unimaginable, life, I'm sure, will persist, but in a radically different form.
So tell me, the series that you've hosted for over 30 years now, called The Nature of Things, can you boil down to a few sentences here at the end what you've learned about the nature of things? Can you give me a nugget of experience we can pass on to audience?
Well, I don't know about the experience through television. Of course, it has given me the opportunity to meet so many amazing people, but the most important person I never met, but she had as great an influence on my life as anybody I've known, was Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson, in 1962, published Silent Spring. And I was a hotshot geneticist then. I'd spent 8 years in the United States getting my education, and I was gonna be this hotshot in Canada. And I read this book, and it just changed my life. And what it said is, the lab is not the real world. You know, you can do all kinds of experiments in a test tube or in a growth chamber. But in a real world, the wind blows, sun sets, night falls, it rains, all kinds of things happen that you don't get in a controlled chamber. That's point one. And the second point is, in nature, everything's connected to everything else. What we do when we look at the world through science, or even through the media, is we isolate and we look at little segments as if they're not interconnected. And that was really the important message to me. The lab is not a miniature replica of the real world. It's an artifact in a way. And Everything in the world is connected, so everything carries responsibilities.
3 years ago, you said you would likely die before your children became mature adults and have their own children. But you said you were filled with hope to imagine their future, and I'm quoting, rich in opportunity, beauty, wonder, and companionship with the rest of creation. As the climate crisis has worsened over the last 3 years, what has happened to your hope?
Well, a lot of my colleagues have now said it's too late. Clive Hamilton, an eminent eco-philosopher in Australia, wrote a book, Requiem for a Species, and we're the species it's a requiem for. I've read everything, the entire book, and there's nothing I disagree with there. James Lovelock, the man who invented this idea of Gaia, says 90% of humanity will be gone by the end of the century. And Sir Martin Rees, the royal astronomer in Britain, was asked, what are the chances humans will be around by 2100? And he said 50-50. So there are a lot of my colleagues who are saying we've passed too many tipping points to go back. My answer is, thank you for the message of urgency. We don't know enough to say it's too late. And this isn't some kind of Pollyanna-ish idea. I based that notion of our ignorance on reality. In the most prized species of salmon in the world is a sockeye salmon. It's got that bright red fatty flesh that we all love. And the largest sockeye salmon run in the world is in Canada in the Fraser River. We like a run of about 20 to 35 million salmon is a good run. That's a lot of fish. And in the year 2009, just over a million sockeye came back to the Fraser. And I said to my wife, that's it. There isn't enough biomass to get them to, they're going extinct. A year later, and the government set up a royal commission to look into what the heck happened to the sockeye salmon. A year later, we got the biggest run of sockeye in 100 years. Now, I like to cite this not to show how stupid I am. Nobody knows what happened. But nature surprised us. And I believe that nature has many more surprises if we can pull back and give her room. And that's the basis of my hope. And that's all I'm left with. I see where the curves are all going. But I still cling to hope as the thing that we've got to grab onto if we give nature a chance.
David Suzuki, thank you very much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
At our website, BillMoyers.com, we debunk some of the biggest lies of the climate change deniers and ask environmental scientists and activists what could be done right now to fight global warming. That's all at BillMoyers.com. I'll see you there, and I'll see you here next time.
Moyers & Company is produced by Public Affairs Television. You can learn more about the team that collaborates to produce the series at BillMoyers.com.